The young man worked swiftly, competently, as if he enjoyed it. Behind him, the conveyor belt kept rising and clattering against the sky. Four distant smokestacks stood like flagpoles, with coils of smoke weaving slowly about them, like long banners at half-mast in the reddish glow of the evening. Mr. Moen had lived with every smokestack of that skyline since the days of his father and grandfather. He had seen the conveyor belt from his office window for 30 years. That the Quinn Ball Bearing Company should vanish from across the street had seemed inconceivable. He had known about Quinn's decision and had not believed it. Or rather, he had believed it as he believed any words he heard or spoke, as sounds that bore no fixed relation to physical reality. Now he knew that it was real. He stood by the flat cars on the siding as if he still had a chance to stop them. "It isn't right," he said. He was speaking to the skyline at large, but the young man above was the only part of it that could hear him. "That's not the way it was in my father's time. I'm not a big shot. I don't want to fight anybody. What's the matter with the world?" There was no answer. "Now you, for instance, are they taking you along to Colorado?" "Me? No, I don't work here. I'm just transient labor, just picked up this job helping to lug the stuff out." "Well, where are you going to go when they move away?" "Haven't any idea." "What are you going to do if more of them move out?" "Wait and see." Mr. Moen glanced up dubiously. He could not tell whether the answer was intended to apply to him or to the young man. But the young man's attention was fixed on his task. He was not looking down. He moved on to the shrouded shapes on the next flat car, and Mr. Moen followed, looking up at him, pleading with something up in space. "I've got rights, haven't I? I was born here. I expected the old companies to be here when I grew up. I expected to run the plant like my father did. A man is part of his community. He's got a right to count on it, hasn't he? Something ought to be done about it." "About what?" "Oh, I know you think it's great, don't you? That Taggart boom and Reardon metal, and the gold rush to Colorado, and the drunken spree out there with Wyatt and his bunch expanding their production like kettles boiling over. Everybody thinks it's great. That's all you hear anywhere you go. People are slap-happy, making plans like six-year-olds on a vacation. You'd think it was a national honeymoon of some kind, or a permanent 4th of July. The young man said nothing. "Well, I don't think so," said Mr. Moen. He lowered his voice. "The newspapers don't say so either, mind you that. The newspapers aren't saying anything." Mr. Moen heard no answer, only the clanking of the chains. "Why are they all running to Colorado?" he asked. "What have they got down there that we haven't got?" The young man grinned. "Maybe it's something you've got that they haven't got." "What?" The young man did not answer. "I don't see it. It's a backward, primitive, unenlightened place. They don't even have a modern government. It's the worst government in any state, the laziest. It does nothing outside of keeping law courts and a police department. It doesn't do anything for the people. It doesn't help anybody. I don't see why all our best companies want to run there." The young man glanced down at him, but did not answer. Mr. Moen sighed. "Things aren't right," he said. "The Equalization of Opportunity Bill was a sound idea. There's got to be a chance for everybody. It's a rotten shame if people like Quinn take unfair advantage of it. Why didn't he let somebody else start manufacturing ball bearings in Colorado? I wish the Colorado people would leave us alone. That Stockton foundry out there had no right going into the switch and signal business. That's been my business. For years I have the right of seniority. It isn't fair. It's dog-eat-dog competition. Newcomers shouldn't be allowed to muscle in. Where am I going to sell switches and signals? There were 2 big railroads out in Colorado. Now the Phoenix Durango's gone, so there's just Taggart Transcontinental left. It isn't fair. They're forcing Dan Conway out. There's got to be room for competition. And I've been waiting 6 months for an order of steel from Orrin Boyle, and now he says he can't promise me anything, because Reardon Metal has shot his market to hell. There's a run on that metal. Boyle has to retrench. It isn't fair. Reardon being allowed to ruin other people's markets that way. And I want to get some Reardon metal, too. I need it, but try and get it. He has a waiting line that would stretch across three states. Nobody can get a scrap of it except his old friends, people like Wyatt and Daniger and such. It isn't fair. It's discrimination. I'm just as good as the next fellow. I'm entitled to my share of that metal. The young man looked up. I was in Pennsylvania last week, he said. I saw the Reardon Mills. There's a place that's busy. They're building four new open hearth furnaces, and they've got six more coming. New furnaces, he said, looking off to the south. Nobody's built a new furnace on the Atlantic coast for the last 5 years. He stood against the sky on the top of a shrouded motor, looking off at the dusk with a faint smile of eagerness and longing, as one looks at the distant vision of one's love. They're busy, he said. Then his smile vanished abruptly. The way he jerked the chain was the first break in the smooth competence of his movements. It looked like a jolt of anger. Mr. Moen looked at the skyline, at the belts, the wheels, the smoke. The smoke that settled heavily, peacefully across the evening air, stretching in a long haze all the way to the city of New York, somewhere beyond the sunset. And he felt reassured by the thought of New York and its ring of sacred fires, the ring of smokestacks, gas tanks, cranes, and high-tension lines. He felt a current of power flowing through every grimy structure of his familiar street. He liked the figure of the young man above him. There was something reassuring in the way he worked. Something that blended with the skyline. Yet Mr. Moen wondered why he felt that a crack was growing somewhere, eating through the solid, the eternal walls. Something ought to be done, said Mr. Moen. A friend of mine went out of business last week, the oil business. Had a couple of wells down in Oklahoma, couldn't compete with Ellis Wyatt. It isn't fair. They ought to leave the little people a chance. They ought to place a limit on Wyatt's output. He shouldn't be allowed to produce so much that he'll swamp everybody else off the market. I got stuck in New York yesterday. Had to leave my car there and come home on a damn commuter's local. Couldn't get any gas for the car. They said there's a shortage of oil in the city. Things aren't right. Something ought to be done about it. Looking at the skyline, Mr. Moen wondered what was the nameless threat to it, and who was its destroyer. "What do you want to do about it?" asked the young man. "Who, me?" said Mr. Moen. "I wouldn't know. I'm not a big shot. I can't solve national problems. I just want to make a living. All I know is somebody ought to do something about it. Things aren't right. Listen, what's your name?"
"Owen Kellogg."
"Listen, Kellogg, what do you think is going to happen to the world? You wouldn't care to know." A whistle blew on a distant tower, the night shift whistle, and Mr. Moen realized that it was getting late. He sighed, buttoning his coat, turning to go. "Well, things are being done," he said. "Steps are being taken. Constructive steps. The legislature has passed a bill giving wider powers to the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. They've appointed a very able man as top coordinator. Can't say I've heard of him before, but the newspapers said he's a man to be watched. His name is Wesley Mooch." Dagny stood at the window of her living room, looking at the city. It was late, and the lights were like the last sparks left glittering on the black remnants of a bonfire. She felt at peace, and she wished she could hold her mind still to let her emotions catch up with her, to look at every moment of the month that had rushed past her. She had had no time to feel that she was back in her own office at Taggart Transcontinental. There had been so much to do that she forgot it was a return from exile. She had not noticed what Jim had said on her return, or whether he had said anything. There had been only one person whose reaction she had wanted to know. She had telephoned the Wayne Falkland Hotel, but Signor Francisco D'Anconia, she was told, had gone back to Buenos Aires. She remembered the moment when she signed her name at the bottom of a long legal page. It was the moment that ended the John Galt line. Now it was the Rio Norte line of Taggart Transcontinental again, except that the men of the train crews refused to give up its name. She, too, found it hard to give up. She forced herself not to call it the John Galt, and wondered why that required an effort, and why she felt a faint wrench of sadness.